It's the Popmatic Podcast for July 15th, 2015.
I'm French! Why do you think I have this outrageous accent, you silly king? Mind your own business! I fart in your general direction! Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries!
This is the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are...
Jeremy.
William.
Michel.
It's just boys. It smells like man cave. But that's also because we're
unbathed like the Frenchman.
Throwing my mustache. Naughty beret.
The smell also has something to do with the fact we're recording from inside the meat locker of the Stockyard restaurant. We will be recording in impromptu locations around downtown Nashville while the children's department here at the main library gets remodeled. But back to the show. Why do we fart in your general direction? Because Bastille Day is June 14th. And what's Bastille Day, library nerds?
It's July 14th.
What did I say?
June 14th.
Oh, good. It actually says June in my notes. Does that make it any worse?
What is? That's the storm. It's going to rain that day, right? It was a storm?
It commemorates the beginning of the French Revolution.
Storming the Bastille.
When they stormed the Bastille prison on the July 14th. 1789. It's kind of like the French 4th of July. And I don't know if this says anything about where our allegiances lie, but our 4th of July episode was late, but our Bastille Day episode is on time.
So today,
everything French. Mike! How French can you get?
Oh, bonjour, mon ami. So today I thought I'd talk about The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas. Focusing mainly on the books, but also with a dash of real history. It's the movies, on card! Oh. As I whip out my rapier.
Watch it with that, man.
Yeah,
aren't safety goggles.
Oh, mon dieu. Much like his contemporary Charles Dickens, Dumas wrote many of his novels in serialized form in newspapers. The Three Musketeers was serialized in Le Cecil in 1844. Fun fact, he based The Three Musketeers on another fictionalized biography of real-life Musketeer D'Artagnan, who was a real guy. He was the head of the Musketeers during Louis XIV. You know, that's which I thought was kind of neat. You know, it's like, oh, an actual historical figure. There's a statue devoted to him in a city called Masseract. On a book that Dumas checked out and never returned to a library in Marseille. So, kids, don't be a Dumas. Return your books to the local library.
Don't be a Dumas.
This podcast is so popular, that's going to catch you up.
Yeah, that's right.
You just broke the internet with that.
Well, that's like the meme. The meme. It was a root beer commercial where they made that.
Yes, I was going to reference that, but I don't know if I can see that in a family-friendly podcast. The basic framework for the story is immediately familiar from the many, many film adaptations. D'Artagnan is a poor young man who travels to Paris to become a member of the Musketeers. When he arrives, he arranges a duel in the same day, like an hour apart, with three members of the guard. Stoic Athos, pious Aramis, and silly goofball Porthos. He becomes friends with them and aids them in their adventures against the vile Cardinal Richelieu and his agent, My Lady de Winter. There are touches of the novel that I don't remember ever seeing in the films, though, and I think it, you know, makes it worth the look, even if you've seen a bunch of the movies. Each of the three musketeers has a sidekick that reflects their personalities, like Athos' servant is so against frivolity that he doesn't speak and only communicates through sign language, which, you know, amuses me. The main plot to take back a necklace that the Queen of France gave to her lover, the Duke of Buckingham, so as to not disgrace the King of France, Louis XIII, involves not only juicy intrigue of the French court, but also juicy intrigue of the English court. that was fun. You know, there's a lot of sword fighting and daring do. I found that with a lot of like classic novels, there's a bit of trouble getting used to the writing style and, you know, trying to figure out the themes and all that stuff. But like, this one is very easy to get into. I mean, you know, especially for a book that's 170 years old and in another language, but it was just like, you know, I was riveted from beginning to end. I read it in like a weekend when I was 19, and it's always like stuck with me. Dumas also wrote two sequels, one of which is so long that it was split up into its own trilogy. The immediate sequel, 20 years after, involves the villainous son of my Lady de Winter, who's out for revenge against the musketeers who killed his mom. Yeah, minor spoiler. 20 years after is kind of neat, at least to me at least, for all the time devoted to Charles I of England, the rise of Cromwell, and the fall of the Commonwealth, which is like the theme in this podcast. We keep mentioning the first period. The English Civil War, I don't know why. But it's pretty neat that, you know, you learn a lot through the footnotes throughout the series about real history, you know. You know, young Mike got to learn about, you know, especially, and 20 years after, there's a lot about George Monk, who was the guy who basically, like, gave England back to the monarchy, which I thought was kind of neat. The last part of the Vicomte de Barlaon trilogy, which is, you know, the third book that's split into three, the third part of the third book, is The Man in the Iron Mask.
Oh, really?
Yes, where the aged musketeers go on one last adventure to rescue the innocent title character from his unjust punishment, imprisonment. I think my favorite favorite film adaptation that we have is from 1993 from Disney. It's got Oliver Platt and Kiefer Sutherland,
Oliver
Chris
Platt.
O'Donnell, and Rebecca De Mornay, and Tim Curry is Cardinal Richelieu. Because, you know,
he's an excellent villain, though.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
You're under arrest.
Five of them, three of us. Hardly seems fair.
Maybe we should give him a chance to surrender.
Excuse me, but there's four of us.
Athos, Porthos, and Aramis.
Hello.
Nice to meet you again.
Pleasure.
Now, we are prepared to resist you.
Walt Disney Pictures presents the story of the greatest heroes who ever lived.
Long live the Musketeer!
It was a time when danger was irresistible.
Did I miss anyone?
King's life is in danger. We have work to do.
1,000 gold pieces on each of their heads, dead or alive.
I prefer...
Kill him!
Dead.
Adventure was everywhere.
I hope we're not interrupting.
Kill those musketeers.
Campaign?
We're in the middle of a chase, Porthos.
And friendship...
You're right. Something red.
...was the greatest weapon of all.
All for one, and more for me.
Charlie Sheen.
We must pray for ourselves. Second thought, guy's often busy.
Kiefer Sutherland.
Save the king!
Chris O'Donnell.
I'm on a mission for the king.
I've heard that before.
Oliver Platt.
That's it. Next time you drive.
Tim Curry.
A snap of my fingers, and you could be back on the block where I found you.
And Rebecca De Mornay.
And with a flick of my wrist, I could change your religion.
The Three Musketeers.
I went to see that movie and did not tell my parents, and I got in trouble.
Over the course of researching this, I discovered that there's a BBC series on right now called The Musketeers. The current Doctor Who, Peter Capaldi, is Richelieu.
Oh.
Which could be fun.
Yeah.
You know.
I like him as a bad guy.
Yeah, he's really good in like the thick of it as this really jerk guy.
Oh.
All right. So.
I want to see him playing a junkie in some movie.
Yeah.
Be a good junkie. He has bags under his eyes already. He's kind of emaciated.
Do you see him when he was young?
No.
He was like the singer in a punk band with Craig, post-punk band. With Craig Ferguson, he's like very like this like gothic sort of Jesus, but not like Jesus. I don't know why I said Jesus.
What do you have, Guillaume?
Well, France has exported a great many products to the United States: perfume, fashion, movies, and heroin. That's right. Dragon, the Big H, China White, and Smack, or just plain heroin, was exported from France to the United States, mainly into New York, in the 1960s to the early 1970s. As a matter of fact, they made a movie about this subject in 1971 called The French Connection. The movie stars Gene Hackman, Fernando Rey, Roy Scheider, and is directed by William Friedkin. The movie is based on the real-life exploits of two New York City narcotic officers, Eddie Egan and Sonny Grosso. The French Connection is an interesting case because it is a movie that barely got made. 20th Century Fox was about to go into bankruptcy. The studio head was David Brown, who asked producer Philip D'Antonio, "Do you have anything for me?" And the movie had a low budget, so they could not afford stars. Gene Hackman was a character actor, but they were wondering, could he carry the lead in the movie?
All right, Popeye's here. Get your hands on your heads. Get off the bar and get on the wall. What's my name?
Popeye Doyle. If he doesn't like you, he'll take you apart. And it's all perfectly legal, because Doyle fights dirty.
You want to take a ride there, fat man?
And plays rough.
Anybody want a milkshake?
Doyle is bad news, but he's a good cop.
Roy Scheider was a total unknown, and William Friedkin was hired because his work in documentaries. But his feature film work was very unsuccessful. Howard Hawks, the director of Red River, was more blunt. He said to William Friedkin, "Your films are lousy. Make a chase picture. Make one better than anyone else." And that's why Friedkin wanted to do The French Connection. To play the French drug smuggler, Friedkin told the casting director he wanted the French actor who was in all the Bunuel films. So they hired Fernando Rey, the wrong Bunuel actor. Mr. Rey is Spanish, too. And when the film was finished, William Friedkin told the producer, "Look, I did the best job I could, but we're not winning any Oscars." It became the first R-rated movie to win Best Picture, along with four other Oscars. If you have not seen this movie, now would be an excellent time. We have it in our collection. Also, check out my Legends of Film podcast. I had to get that in. For my Randy Jurgensen interview, who was an ex-New York City police officer who worked the actual French Connection case. And he was in the movie, too. Jeremy.
All right. False starts sort of define my journey to this podcast. I've been wanting to read the novels of Jean-Patrick Manchet, but I couldn't get into either The Mad and the Bad or The Prone Gunman. Then I thought I'd talk about Le Samurai, but I took a couple of vacation days this week and got too lazy to read subtitles. I did watch 50 Shades of Grey instead, but even I can't justify sort of making a leap from that to The Marquis de Sade.
I'm sure that's rated G in France.
Yeah.
Le Guy.
So what it comes down to is this. Ultimately, what I really wanted to talk about was Coneheads, the movie, because of the We Come From France joke, and because it was a pretty terrible movie that I watched on HBO a few dozen times one summer, and because Chris Farley has a really funny line about his mom eating sandwiches. But I was stymied again because the library no longer owns this title. It's not even on Hoopla, but the soundtrack is. And so movie soundtracks can fall into a few categories. There's obviously the original score, which is the composer's musical interpretation of the action, drama, etc. on screen. Saying that would give me a good chance to use the term mise en scène.
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
There's also the lazy hit song collection designed to easily evoke the era in which a film is set and move units at Starbucks or Target or wherever people still buy new CDs. I'm thinking of the Big Chill soundtrack or Dirty Dancing. Of course, all of my references are 20 years old or older.
Pretty
close to 30 years old. So an example of a great soundtrack is the music for Pulp Fiction. So this Quentin Tarantino curated soundtrack is sort of peppered with dialogue from the film and contains songs which play prominent roles in the film. And in fact, you can kind of listen to the soundtrack and it's almost like watching the movie because the songs are such major players in the scene. Now the Coneheads soundtrack is sort of the inverse of something like the Pulp Fiction soundtrack. It features a collection of B-sides and outtakes from the Warner Brothers stable of artists. The Warner Brothers released the soundtrack. Not to mention the sort of perennial soundtrack and trailer filler Tainted Love by Soft Cell, which is no disrespect intended to Soft Cell. It's just people use that a lot. And then somehow this soundtrack... What?
Oh, I liked Kodachrome.
Oh, yeah, see, Kodachrome is also on there. And somehow the soundtrack also spawned a hit single in the form of the Red Hot Chili Peppers' Soul to Squeeze.
Well, I got a bad disease. All from my brain is where I bleed. It's got me by my soul to squeeze.
The songs in this movie sort of serve the same function as the music bumping in the car next to you at a stoplight, or the stuff playing softly over pleas for cashiers at the grocery store. They don't give insight into the characters, and they don't give the audience emotional cues, and on the whole, they're actually not very good. There's a Kodachrome is pretty great. There is a really good Diggable Planets song.
Go fast, we get up, that's the natural high. Higher than some Pluto, plus we took off clean. Squeezing in the mute request, 6 miles tunes. You could get just pit like a banana. Pete, roll one of my pants leg up on pork side. Caps and wraps and snaps, we in the soup. Kevin in the county, I got serious love. 50,000 legs of black. Deep neck up to the 83, trip to 93. Forced at the crosswalk strut.
That, you know, maybe you liked that Cool Like That song and then bought this soundtrack and enjoyed it. The soundtrack is a fascinating artifact, though, because it brings together a number of elements which have no business being together. Simon and Garfunkel, Bare Naked Ladies, and a terrible cover of Magic Carpet Ride featuring Slash on guitar, and it sort of places them all under the umbrella of intellectual property, which at the time of its release was already 20 years old, which is now being used to sell insurance. The French have a word for that, and it is absurde.
Ryan? Well, I was not expecting the soundtrack to Coneheads to be your French entry. I mean, Moebius or whatever. Yeah.
Wow.
Magnifique.
Wow.
Superb.
That has to be me talking about the station agent on the weather episode.
Yes, 100%. You joined the Brian Club.
They say we come from France.
But better, you totally... Okay, you talked for like the first half wasn't about what you were talking about.
Yes, I know. I went back to my old ways.
But then when you actually went to the item you could get from the library you were going to talk about, the premise was, well, actually... It's nothing like a really good soundtrack.
I said it's a fascinating artifact. It's a fascinating artifact.
I was clapping because I was impressed that you came up with that. That was really good.
It's kind of amazing.
I mean, all of ours feel so obvious right now.
Yeah,
right?
Right? People are like, you know, obviously they're going to mention, you know, the candy bar.
I don't want to say this, but this is an excerpt from an article I wrote for Cahiers du Cinéma.
Hey, wait, that's the perfect transition. I'm going to talk about an old snobby movie.
Excellent.
That's the perfect transition. So I did want to go back, and we're going to actually talk about a French movie, The Passion of Joan of Arc. Now, this is way back, 1928. And if you think you don't like silent movies, this is the one you should check out.
Totally.
Let me sell it to you. It really should be called The Trial of Joan of Arc and not The Passion of Joan of Arc, because the script is actually taken from the actual historical transcripts of her trial. So, like, the things that the people say are quotes, like, from Joan of Arc's trial.
Wow.
And though it is an old movie, but at least by the standards of cinema, the film's look will startle you. It's all close-ups of the actors at strange angles, and they actually built an entire castle for the set. And the interiors are this great mix of like modernism, but also like medieval austerity. And the art directors were Herman Varm, who was the art director on the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, mm-hmm. and Jean Yago, the famous artist. The sets are just so cool. The result is stunning. When you watch this movie, it feels contemporary. It does not feel like an old movie mm-hmm. at all. And Renee Falconetti plays Joan. She crushes it, or should I say she burns it down?
Oh.
Too soon.
It's mostly just close-ups. So it really like relies on her performance, and she totally brings it. I think we all know what ultimately happens to Joan of Arc. That's why my burning it down thing was funny. Or not.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Yeah. But I think, you know...
There's much at stake.
Oh.
Wow.
But history is always stranger than fiction, and the actual things that went down during Joan of Arc's trial are shady and bizarre and weird. And this movie will crush you emotionally. It is like up. We almost might even say it's torture porn. Like I could see definitely like people like now critiquing this movie that it's just all about a woman being tortured psychologically.
I think that's what the passion, you know, it's like the passion to Christ, you know, that kind of, they don't mean like, you know, fervor. They mean.
So even though this movie is fantastic and it's recognized as such, it was culturally not accepted in France at the time because it was directed by a Dane.
Ooh.
I fought your general direction. So even worse, the director was Carl Dreyer, by the way, the great, amazing film director. But it was even worse, Renee Falconetti was Italian, and obviously an Italian woman could not play Joan of Arc. In France, after World War I, there was sort of this resurgence of Joan of Arc as a national symbol. So this was just not cool that a Dane directed the movie and Joan was played by an Italian.
Zut alors.
And since then, so it was cut up in a lot of different ways and censored throughout the years. And the original version of this film was thought to be lost. A lot of movies from this period, from the 20s and early 30s, are just destroyed. Film from that era likes to catch on fire, literally.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, this movie, even though it was regarded as a masterpiece, was thought lost, and I'm not making this up, an original director's cut was found in the janitor's closet of a psychiatric hospital in 1981.
Cool.
Yeah. So
how
this,
does that happen?
Yeah. Well, the theory is that the guy who was the director of the psychiatric hospital, he was like a published historian, like he was a history scholar, and he probably was interested in this movie. So instead of just ordering like the Mickey Mouse movies or whatever, he ordered this art film from this famous director. So now the library has this restored awesome version on DVD from the Criterion Collection. You should check it out. It is an amazing film.
It is. I watched that in a film class in college, and it is. Like, if you don't like silent movies, it is absolutely...
Yeah.
If you think you don't like them, it's one to watch. Because it does feel modern, and it doesn't have that staginess, maybe, that the others have.
Yeah,
It's not like having to sort of put your mind in the context of that you're watching. It's like...
It's just like saying that, you know, that there's close-ups. It's kind of a surprise.
Some
stuff back then. It's like it's a play.
Absolutely. And it's,
so you're at a distance the whole time, and it kind of is distracting.
That's really remarkable.
Well, one of the reasons why it kind of feels so real, too, is the close-ups, but he also didn't use makeup in a lot of the actors. That was, like, totally unheard of.
That was a like dramatic.
So no makeup on the actors. And then also he cast people based on their facial types to, like, look a certain way. So like no makeup, high contrast lighting, so they all look like these basically they look like theatrical characters without the use of makeup. And in it too, this is the French episode, I have to put this in there, but Antoine Artaud, the famous absurdist playwright, he actually plays a monk in this in this movie. That's a good French factoid. So anyway, I said the Criterion put it out on DVD, and we say that a lot on this podcast, so I thought it might be worth noting like what in the hell the Criterion Collection is. So they're a company that puts out, quote, important classic and contemporary films. That's their own description. They started with Laserdiscs and then DVDs and Blu-ray, and they've still put out DVDs and Blu-ray both. And so the idea was that they would sort of set the standard of home versions for film lovers. And with their Laserdiscs, they were the first person to standardize the way to do letterboxing on widescreen movies. So like the black bars, so the film is actually in the proportions that the director shot it. If you're the kind of person that does not like that, you probably don't want to worry about
watching any of the movies.
Yeah, exactly. And also putting audio commentaries on films, and also doing original scores. So with Joan of Arc, they commissioned a composer to do an original score. Or when you can watch it with that original score, or you can watch it silently. or your own soundtrack, whatever, however you want to watch it. So these things that we think are very typical, or we expect from really good high-end DVDs, these are practices that the Criterion Collection started with their Laserdiscs. Now, with the advent of digital software, they started like restoring movies digitally. So even this copy from 1981 from the closet at the psychiatric hospital of Joan of Arc, it looked pretty up. Excuse me. Bad. So what they did was, you know, they would pay to have these films digitally restored so they actually looked new again without compromising the artistic vision of the director. Like,
also really big on special features.
Yeah.
You know, oh, yeah. I mean, they'll have entire discs of special features.
Yeah.
Also, if you want to actually own some Criterion, that Barnes & Noble has a 50% off sale right now for the rest of the month on Criterion Collection stuff only.
They do that occasionally, and yes. Hulu Plus has a lot of Criterion.
Hulu has a lot, yeah.
Hulu Plus has a lot of Criterion stuff streaming.
Lest we forget, this is a library podcast. You can simply search for Criterion Collection in the search box of the library's catalog and get over 500 Criterion Collection DVDs.
And they also have like film essays, you know, like really good, like not just garbage extras too, like interesting historical stuff about the films.
I've got the Battle of Algiers Criterion. It's like three discs.
Yeah, I need to see that.
It's awesome.
When my partner and I were dating, when we would go to the movies together, I would embarrass them. But when we walked in and bought the tickets, when we were like walking to the movie, I'd be like, and I'd always go, "This isn't one of those art movies like the Battle of Algiers, is it?" Like, she would just look at me mortified. But anyway.
I'm not even a bicycle thief.
So here I am talking about the Passion of Joan of Arc on the
snob card.
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
So, the Criterion Collection has become so ubiquitous amongst film lovers that it's actually started to be criticized. I know here at the library, if it's a film that the Criterion Collection has released on DVD, like, it always gets at least some circs. Where if it was just an old foreign movie that we had on DVD, it wouldn't circulate that much.
Yeah, yeah.
But if it's a Criterion Collection DVD, it will circulate more.
They released a trilogy of Wallace Shawn's and that guy from My Dinner with Andre, the other guy.
Andre Grigory.
Yeah, that guy, Andre Grigory. They released all three of them on Blu-ray recently and DVD. We got them on DVD. One of them's like was a rush the minute it came out, which is weird because it's a 30-year-old movie adapted from a play, but Criterion Collection.
Well, they also put out Armageddon.
RoboCop.
And Spinal Tap.
So I'm getting there.
But those are out
of original print. Godzilla, which, you know, they did a very excellent.
So there's been this criticism that instead of releasing, you know, quote, important classic and contemporary films, they're actually pruning the canon, that they actually determine which films are important and classic because they've been put out.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these films actually, like, wouldn't exist. They were never put out on VHS. They were never put out on, you know, other formats.
The Friends of Eddie Coyle is an example.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh.
So, and then, of course, they also have cash cows, right? So, like, they put out at least Armageddon, for sure.
Yeah.
But that, like, is kind of an amazing, horrible movie, if you've ever seen it.
It's so weird to keep the Criterion Collection.
Yeah,
but, like, for me, a really good example is they put out every Wes Anderson movie now.
Oh, yeah.
Even the ones that people don't like.
I was going to bring that up. yes, they do, and I've tracked them down on Blu-ray. It's good times. That's it. House. Awesome Japanese bizarre horror film.
Yeah.
Which we've talked about this before, but the Criterion cover of House was designed
by Sam Smith.
Was designed by Sam Smith, local designer musician.
Really?
Yeah.
I got a poster signed by him.
Bill Sienkiewicz did the Godzilla.
So that's the Criterion Collection. That's what we're talking about when we say the Criterion Collection put it out. Their version of RoboCop on Laserdisc is a reason to own a Laserdisc.
I'd buy that for $1.
Oh, genius.
Can we do the intro?
Yeah.
Sure. Hey, guys.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, Brian. Hey. Maybe the library has it.
Maybe the library doesn't. But it's tickling our fancy this week.
Mac?
Oh,
I guess I'll go first. Tickling my fancy this week. Yeah. Spoiler alert.
Whoa!
So way back during Shocktober, I went with my sister to an amazing restaurant that's just been spoiled, that I was kind of dying to recommend on the podcast, but alas, it's not horror-related. Though it's kind of horrifying if you have good taste. So I had to skip it. But, you know, my sister will be back in town this evening, and she suggests we return. So, oh boy, oh boy, I even dressed up for the occasion today in my finest hula girl dancing shirt. It's called the Omni Hut, and it's way out in Smyrna.
Whoa.
It's an old-school tiki-slash-Polynesian restaurant. It is so ridiculously kitschy and cheesy. I'm in love. Oh, boy. Do you like bamboo decor right out of Gilligan's Island? Do you like a tiny fountain in a hallway for no reason? Do you like zillions of tiki masks hanging on the walls that, you know, all of them? There's, like, so many. do you like constant ukulele music? I kind of did a happy dance when I heard Aloha Oe, because that's the only one I can recognize. Then this place is for you, oh boy. And the food is really good too. Might I recommend for your first adding the fiery poo-poo on the popo platter?
Oh no.
Oh yes. The, to get a feel for all the appetizers, the teriyaki sauce, which they use in nearly everything, has a hint of pine.
Did you say appetizers?
Yes, they give you hepatitis. I can't wait.
We have braised needles on a bed of coconut rice.
Would you like C or B? Which one's the lethal one? I'll pass on that one.
I didn't hear, for the record, I did not hear hepatizers.
Hepatizers.
Sorry.
You know, I apologize. It's so groovy 60s that it's so hep that they give out hepatizers.
Oh, that's what I meant.
There you go. The teriyaki sauce, which they use in nearly everything, has a hint of pineapple in it. Very good. Oh, and the Hawaiian tea, which tastes like a cross between sweet tea and Hawaiian punch, is outstanding.
What?
Yes.
Do they have vegetarian options?
Yes.
Okay.
Coconuts. So just hand them to you.
Here you go. Here's some salt water. It was a really great...
I liked it so much, I walked up to the hostess, like, what do you have that I can buy? I will buy anything. T-shirts, you know. I wanted a mug so bad. The only mugs that they have are, like, you know, they can't give away now. They used to sell them, but they can't now, because they have this, like, ridiculous tiki mug that has, like, the Omni Hut.
Is it an old place that's just
yes,
still...
Yes, it's a 50-year-old institution that has, like, there's pictures on the walls of, like, the founder and when he went to, like, Russia and stuff to, like, try to get tiki culture in there. And,
in Smyrna?
Yes.
Jeez.
Awesome.
It is amazing.
Have you been there?
Yeah, that's the ticket.
Yeah. Can you imagine humorless McKilljoy?
Brian will say, oh, you tell the truth on the podcast? You tell the truth on the podcast?
Tickling my fancy.
Aloha, Bill.
Is Aeriscope Pictures. Go online, type in aeriscope.com. I'll send Brian a link. And this is director Adam Green's website. Adam Green is responsible for Halston, the television show. He's the director of Hatchet, Frozen, Spiral, and Digging Up the Marrow. On this website is the Movie Crypt, which I've talked about before. But you can click on Original Online Series, and is Adam Green's Scary Sleepover, in which people like Bill Moseley, Emma Bell, Darren Lynn Bozeman, Sid Haig, Kane Hodder, come to his house or production company and have a scary sleepover. It's quite funny. Also, the original series, 20 Seconds to Live, it's pretty much summed up by the title. And coming on July 17th is Horrified, which is people from the entertainment field tell horrifying personal stories, hosted by Corey English. Horoscope Pictures, like I say, go to Aeriscope Pictures, go to aeriscope.com. And according to Adam Green, remember, at the end of the day, we're not curing cancer. We're just making life more entertaining before getting cancer. Jeremy.
That's Criterion, the new logo. That's Criterion, the new slogan.
So, tickling my fancy this week. At the beginning of the year, when we talked about what we were looking forward to this year, I said I was looking forward to the end of Mad Men. So I finally watched the final episodes this past week. I didn't get to watch them in their run because I don't have AMC, but we paid for them on Amazon Prime. And that's the first time I've ever paid for something like that.
How do you feel now? Fine. How do you feel now telling the truth on the podcast?
Oh.
I feel okay.
I paid for the last season of American Horror Story, and I wish I could get my money back.
Oh. Well, this, I don't
it's
feel
quite
that
freakish
way.
Freakish and not in a fun way.
Oh. Well, these were pretty good. I wasn't blown away by the final episodes, but I enjoyed them as much as I did all the other stuff. And it didn't have too much spoil for me. I knew some things that happened toward the end. There was one kind of major event that took place that I didn't know about. So that was surprising. I did kind of have like a couple of the sort of iconic, I guess, moments from the ending. I'd seen pictures of them. I tried to stay away, but you know, so I won't spoil anything here. But I will say that probably the moment that stuck with me the most, there's a scene where little Bobby Draper is in the kitchen and he is scraping the burn part off of toast and scraping into the sink because he's burned some bread. And little Jean Draper is sitting at the table. Sally comes in and they're talking, and Bobby says like, "I was making dinner," and he like has this like, he shakes his head like, puts his hands out like, "What can you do?" And it was the saddest thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm like starting to tear up even now. I started sobbing, like uncontrollably sobbing in this moment, and I cried so hard that I started laughing because I was like, "Why am I crying so hard?" And I had to pause it, and then I had to go back and watch it again, and I didn't cry as hard. But I swear to you, being honest on the podcast, I was crying uncontrollably as this little boy scraped burned stuff off of toast into the sink.
So it was worth the money you paid.
So yeah. $30 for a...
Oh, no, it wasn't 30. It was like $15. It was like $2. It was only 7 episodes, maybe. So it was $2 each. So I won't pay for sex, but I'll pay to cry.
I want to say that...
sure. A release of a different kind.
Television a la carte that you pay for, that what you want to see, is an amazing innovation. And F you cable for making that not be existing for years.
Way
and,
to kill yourself slowly.
You know, God bless America that we can do that. And it's funny, I'm a librarian. I hate Amazon for almost every conceivable reason in the book. But a la carte television, which you can get from Amazon, has been good to me.
Pretty nice. So check it out. Do you have anything?
What'd you think of Don Draper getting the six change?
You know, he looks good as a lady. Once he gets rid of that 5 o'clock shadow.
I missed that.
Dana that, Draper?
That almost makes me want to watch it.
So what's tickling my fancy are these awesome handmade clocks that Mike's dad gave us as a present. Thank you, Mike's dad.
Thank you, Johnny.
Johnny, thank you.
That was really, really sweet. I'm not going to cry as much as I did during the final episode of Mad Men.
I'm going to glue it to the top of my laptop somehow to be my laptop clock.
Amanda also thanks you when she gets hers.
Yes, Amanda.
Yes, we'll make her say that next week.
Oh. Bill would like you to make her another one.
Can you make a replacement, Dad?
Oh, it took a lick and it came out.
That's a good ending, I think.
Does anyone have any corrections?
Nah.
No, I don't think so.
The Monty Python theme is Liberty Bell.
All right.
Or the Liberty Bell March by John Philip Sousa.
Uh-huh. But you saying that makes me think that someone said something like he wrote it for Monty Python, but then we also said he had died.
No, he didn't write it for Monty Python. It's just they used that as the theme.
Monty Python used it because it was in the public domain.
Yeah.
Amanda gave me Andre Ruse live in New York for the Sousa samples, but it was just easier for me to go and download cuts from Friegel. Stars and Stripes Forever was Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops Orchestra from their album Stars and Stripes Forever, The Greatest Marches. Washington Post was Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic from their album Great Marches. If you type in marches on Friegel, they'll both be on right there on the first page. I apologize to Amanda if I compromised your artistic vision. All right, for more information about Andre Rue, is that how you say that guy's name? That was my big anxiety this whole week. How do you say this name?
I didn't see it spelled.
R-I-E-U.
That'd be
is that
guess.
French?
Magnifique.
Oh. So for more of Andre Rue's albums and other French stuff, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week,
Shut your mouth.
I don't know.
It's the 70s?
It's the 70s. All right.
So, my niece watched that movie this week.
Replace the microwave cooking device.
Oh, this will cost mass quantities.
Commence the jingle.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, Beldar, how can I help?
Brent Allen, did we receive savings from our discount double check?
Oh, yeah, a bunch.
This pleases me.
Wait, we're in space. I thought you guys were from France.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
In France. See? France?
Oui.
Save mass quantities with a State Farm discount double check.